not a man for president who's seasoned through and through. But that's a doggone season that he won't try something new. A man who's old enough to know
and young enough to do.
Well, it's up to you, it's up to you.
It's strictly up to you.
But it's Kennedy, 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 Kennedy.
Ah, that'll take you back to 1960 and get you in the mood for this hour's conversation. The co-author of The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's 5-year campaign. The authors write, the campaign was a long, continuous pursuit, at first tentative, with Kennedy appearing detached, even doubtful. By the end of the summer of 1956, Kennedy felt the presidency was staring him in the face. On Thanksgiving of that year, he made the commitment to start running. And this book is all about that. It is told with great care and great detail and well-chosen words. And the co-author of the book, Curtis Wilkie, is with us. He was a national and foreign correspondent for the Boston Globe. He teaches journalism at the University of Mississippi. And this book has been praised by many, including E.J. Dionne, who says this book is a gift to history, to all who love politics, and to anyone who likes a good story. It is brilliantly told. And we're going to pay some special attention to a couple different areas. One is Wisconsin, an important primary here in Wisconsin, where Hubert Humphrey from the neighboring state of Minnesota was his chief rival. We'll talk about Wisconsin, that all-important primary in West Virginia, and a whole cast of characters who were so important to the victory that John F. Kennedy got in securing the nomination and then winning the presidency in 1960. So we're delighted to have Curtis with us this hour. Hi, Curtis. Thanks so much for being with us.
Kathleen, thanks for inviting us. I'm sorry you have to put up with me. My co-author is, I don't understand why, but he's on vacation in Mongolia.
Oh, well, I'm happy to put up with you. You have
all
to,
right,
yeah,
good.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I haven't read all of it, but I've read a big chunk of it. I'm fascinated by this time in history, and it is so well done. I never knew the story that this whole thing really started with JFK's father's concern, and it's how you start the book, about Eisenhower's health in 1955.
Right. The old man had obviously always had an interest in one of his sons becoming president, and he saw an opening in 55 when President Eisenhower was slowed down considerably by a heart attack, and he thought that Lyndon Johnson would be a very good candidate. Of course, Johnson also had a heart attack that complicated things that year, but Joe Kennedy actually made an overture to LBJ, and he would basically help finance the whole campaign if LBJ would take JFK as his running mate. And Lyndon Johnson didn't think much of the deal and turned him down. And you know, we found in the Kennedy Library some interesting correspondence between the two of them, including a letter back from LBJ saying, you know, thanks for the interest, but I'm not interested, or something to that effect.
You also, and this is what I love about the book, you have all these insights that it was the matter, you say, was dropped quietly, although there was an outburst from younger brother Bobby.
Bobby was, he was quite a tempestuous character. And not at all the Bobby Kennedy that we later grew to know in the 60s and basically after his brother's death. But Bob Kennedy was he was the guy who quite often ran against the grain, and of course it sometimes so did his brother. But he was mercurial. He was certainly more conservative than JFK at that time, and JFK was not a raging liberal.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting all sorts of interesting family dynamics that played out, also involving the father.
Right, and we'll dispel some of the myths that we have about the father. But let's first talk about who Jack Kennedy was in the 1950s. Not a figure, you say, in national politics. He hadn't done a whole lot, had he?
No, he hadn't. He was a young senator. He was a freshman senator elected in 1952. He'd been a congressman before that, but a very nondescript character. He began to attract some interest in 1956. He went to the Democratic convention in 1956, suspecting that Adlai Stevenson, who was going to get the nomination, would throw the selection of his running mate to the convention. Kennedy had some inside information from people within the Stevenson campaign, so he prepared for it, and he went to that convention. And when Adlai Stevenson did indeed ask the delegates to choose his running mate, Kennedy was well prepared and nearly won. It was I watched it as a teenager.
Yeah, I thought you did.
I was spellbound. It was the first convention I had ever watched on TV. I would have been nearly 16. And to this day, I think it was one of the most exciting political afternoons I've ever experienced. It was the last time a convention has gone past the first ballot, and it wound up being a battle between Kennedy and Kefauver. Kefauver ultimately prevailed. Kefauver was a senator from Tennessee, and Kennedy made a name for himself, and he pulled out of the race very graciously with the speech, and everybody left Chicago, the convention site, feeling very good about this promising young man from Massachusetts. Mm. I think generally people thought, well, he'll be a good running mate for whoever gets the nomination 60, but Jack Kennedy didn't think that way. He thought, why not go for the real thing instead of running for vice president again?
And Stevenson figures prominently in the book in other ways, too. Why did he decide to not choose a VP and throw it to the convention?
I think it is, and this is just my own speculation from trying to read up and study Stevenson. It was another example of how he was ineffectual at reaching decisions. I think that was a real shortcoming of Stevenson, a brilliant intellectual guy, articulate, but he couldn't make decisions. And rather than make a hard decision for a running mate this time, he let somebody else do it for him. And we saw it again 4 years later when Kennedy is basically closing in on the nomination. And Stevenson repeatedly dithers over whether he's going to seek the nomination again. And finally, at the very last minute, he decides to run. And by that time, it's far too late. And even some of his biggest and best supporters, such as Eleanor Roosevelt, were exasperated with Stevenson.
Hmm. Let's talk about the father now, because the father originally thought it was a terrible idea for Kennedy to try and secure the vice presidential spot on the Stevenson ticket. It would be the end of his political dreams, etc. So you present this view of the father. He did give a whole lot of money to people like sheriffs in West Virginia, but he also was somewhat ignored by JFK. His advice was listened to but not taken.
Repeatedly rejected, and they gladly used his money, Bob Kennedy and Jack Kennedy. No question that the old man supplied so much of the money, and at the same time, virtually every time we could come up with an instance where Joe Kennedy was recommending something, it was rejected. The 56 convention is a good example that he thought it was crazy for Jack Kennedy to try to get on the ticket with Adlai Stevenson, because by that time Eisenhower had recovered. Eisenhower was incumbent, a heavy favorite to be reelected, and Joe Kennedy felt it would sully Jack Kennedy's reputation. He'd become a loser, and therefore that would be the end of his ambitions. And, of course, Jack Kennedy felt the other way, went into it There was even a transatlantic telephone call the night that Jack Kennedy jumped into that race in Chicago at the convention. And the old man was calling him an idiot for getting involved. And all this was, he was talking to Bob Kennedy, and some members of the family were in the room overhearing this conversation with the old man ranting at Bob Kennedy and by extension, Jack Kennedy. But turns out, had Kennedy not run for that that place on the ticket in 56, he probably would have kind of disappeared into history as a senator from Massachusetts.
He sure surrounded himself with that notable Irish mafia with people like Ted Sorensen, but he factors heavily into this book. And what a young guy he was. He'd been a top aide for 2 years, and he was 27 years old when all of this was going on.
Right. Jack Kennedy called him his intellectual blood bank, which I thought was good.
Yeah, that's good.
Question, you know, and Ted Sorensen, of course, was a Midwesterner and a Protestant. He was from Nebraska, so he didn't really fit into the Irish mafia, but he was, there was no one closer to Jack Kennedy, say, other than obviously the brother Bob, than Ted Sorensen. He traveled with him everywhere. He wrote so many of his speeches. He was the guy that Kennedy bounced ideas off on. But then you get to the real Irish mafia, and the guys like, you know, Larry O'Brien and Dick Donahue and Kenny O'Donnell and Dave Powers, you know, they are Irish, and they're all from Massachusetts, and they're and they were not, I think the expression the Irish mafia connotes a bunch of hack politicians
[S2] Yes. [S1]
From Boston, and they weren't. These were very smart, cunning people with very good educations. You know, they go to Harvard, they go to Dartmouth, places like that. So they were a very smart group of people.
Mm-hmm. I keep thinking how important the connection was with Sorensen. You write about the fact that, and I want to ask about if their politics were similar. You talk about Sorensen's family having deep progressive roots. He was instrumental in helping Kennedy work on policy and then also being able to write speeches and write articles as well. Were his politics in line with Kennedy's, or was he essentially more progressive than Kennedy?
I will bet that Ted Sorensen at heart was probably more progressive at the beginning, because there were certainly a lot of conservative characteristics to Kennedy. But they essentially, I think that everything dovetailed, and it was probably a situation where Ted Sorensen could probably finish a sentence for Kennedy in a conversation.
Mm. So what did he say? There was speculation. Tell me how early this speculation started about Kennedy's health. And he had less than a year removed from two major spinal surgeries, long recuperation. He almost died during one of those. Then it was somebody was saying that he had had Addison's disease. How did Sorensen treat those illnesses, and how did those not become major issues?
Not to put too fine a point on it, they lied about it.
Mm.
Kennedy was not a healthy man, and as you described, he had been hospitalized. He was suffering from a serious illness, Addison's disease, and receiving some fairly dangerous treatment for it. And you know, the campaign and people around Kennedy always dismissed his problems as being related to his injury in World War II, when after his PT boat was run over and he was rescued and suffered, you know, back injuries, that it all related to that. And I'm sure that probably complicated the situation, but you know, Kennedy was a sick man, and the public really never knew the extent of it. LBJ tried to raise it at the showdown at the 1960 convention, and he began referring to Kennedy privately as a sickly little man, and et cetera, et cetera. LBJ was really pretty ugly about it, and and the Kennedy people would deny it, and LBJ got a proxy to hold a press conference at the Democratic Convention in 1960 to raise the issue of Kennedy's health in a last-minute attempt to circumvent the nomination. And if that failed, and Johnson had to pull in his horns, and then, ironically, you know, he gets chosen as Kennedy's running mate.
Yeah. You would never know, though, from the way that this guy campaigned and the whole family campaigned, what a schedule, and for such a long time.
It was, Tom and I say, you know, it was the first modern campaign. This was a guy who set out basically more than 4 years before the election and campaigned relentlessly all over the country. Cultivated followers in every state in the union. He hired his own pollster, first presidential candidate to have his own pollster to provide guidance and kind of intelligence, if you will. Kennedy had his own media advisors, all sort of things no other candidate before that time had ever considered taking on a staff like this. And, the Kennedy campaign invented the first of the very short commercials. Up until then, you generally have a five-minute boring commercial where a candidate would speak for 5 minutes. And, the Kennedy campaign, crafted, 30-second spots and things like that.
You mentioned Johnson. Tell the story. We'll jump around a bit because the book goes through many years and lots of different events. How did Lyndon Johnson, this is an interesting story, and the confusion surrounding this is fascinating. How did he get selected to be the VP spot?
Well, with the caveat that either Bob or Jack Kennedy said, and maybe they both did, no one will ever know how LBJ ultimately was chosen. But then later on, Bob Kennedy gave a very long oral history to the Kennedy Library, more than 1,000 pages, and he gets into his version of it. And then there's another version from the Johnson side, and you largely see that in the biographical works of Robert Caro, who's, now on his fourth or fifth volume, and they seem to have a great deal of authority, too. So there are conflicts in the narrative. But basically, Kennedy has just secured the nomination. He had been planning to choose Senator Stuart Symington from Missouri. It would be a good mainline kind of vice presidential candidate, smart, basically liberal, appealing guy, nice-looking fellow out of central casting. And he and his brother had actually leaked that to a couple of friends who were reporters the day before, so they could be the first into print with the fact that Symington's going to be chosen. So Kennedy is back at his hideaway spot after he's won the nomination, and he gets a message from LBJ that says, LBJ now stands for Let's Back Jack. And I think Kennedy had always been wary of Lyndon Johnson. He was a Senate Majority Leader in theory. He had more power than Jack Kennedy certainly did in the Senate. And Kennedy had had to defer to him, and suddenly this guy is basically almost paying fealty to him. And Kennedy counts up the votes in Texas. Not that he hadn't done it before, but he basically begins to change his mind almost overnight, and he gets back to his hotel suite in L.A. And he indicates that he's considering Johnson, and virtually everybody around Kennedy is appalled, said, you can't do this. Bobby Kennedy certainly objected to it. Bobby Kennedy and LBJ despised each other. I mean, the hatred could be cut with a knife. And Kennedy goes down and talks to Johnson, finds that Johnson is receptive to the idea. Kennedy had figured Johnson would never be interested in playing second fiddle to him. Kennedy goes back upstairs to his suite, and he says to Bobby, "My God, he wants it." And that creates a real dilemma. What are they going to do? So they send Bobby down and to feel him out and say, "Wouldn't you be interested in something else? Wouldn't you be more interested in being chairman of the Democratic National Committee?" And, you know, Johnson, you know, and Sam Rayburn was in the room with him, Sam Rayburn being the Speaker of the House from Texas and Johnson's confidant. And you know, they've responded, you know, in words a little crasser than hell no, but, you know, they weren't interested, you know, but they were interested in becoming his running mate. And it went back and forth. And finally, we wind up with Lyndon Johnson. And I think the bottom line was Kennedy looked very hard at the electoral votes that Texas controlled and the help that Johnson could give him and the southern states to provide the requisite number of electoral college votes.
Would he have won with Symington as his running mate, do you think?
Good question. He might not have because that election was so very close.
Yes, it was close.
Symington obviously couldn't have delivered Texas, and Texas wound up being very, very close, even with the presence of Johnson. So one can extrapolate that Symington couldn't have delivered Texas. And I don't think I'm a Southerner. I don't think Symington would have helped as much as Johnson did in the South.
We're speaking this hour with a co-author of The Road to Camelot. It's a fascinating book. If you're interested in this time in history, it's really very well researched and beautifully written inside JFK's 5-year campaign. The book starts with Dwight Eisenhower's heart attack in 1955 and what happened since then in terms of JFK's plans to make himself known nationally and when he decided to run for the presidency and how he did it. We're welcoming phone calls if you'd like to join the conversation. Curtis Wilkie was a national and foreign correspondent for the Boston Globe. He teaches journalism at the University of Mississippi. He's the author of The Fall of the House of Zeus, and he's with us this hour to talk about this time. We'd love to hear from you. Some of you may remember John F. Kennedy's time in Wisconsin. I want to talk about the Wisconsin primary, which was very important. A little bit more about Hubert Humphrey, who's always on, he plays a central role in so much of this book, but on the periphery, and poor Hubert never really got what he wanted. He lost in Wisconsin, not by that much. We'll talk about the race here and the all-important race in West Virginia, where Catholicism was dealt with head-on. Our guest writes that this actually was an issue throughout the whole campaign. And we have to talk about the race against Richard Nixon, too. We have a lot to cover. So we welcome your phone calls. We'll continue our conversation in a moment here on the Ideas Network. We want to center on some of the primaries that were all important in 1960. One of them, of course, took place right here in Wisconsin. And this is Kennedy when it was determined that he had won, not by much, but he had won the Wisconsin primary. And our guest will talk about that primary in just a moment.
Are you surprised at Senator Humphrey's race at all?
No, I always thought he was a very formidable opponent. After all, Wisconsin, Minnesota join each other, and I come from some hundreds of miles away from here. I thought we did fine.
Well, you said this was a make-or-break primary campaign. I guess it'd be safe to say it's a make, is that it?
Well, I think we're still very much in the race.
What's next, Senator Kennedy?
Well, I'm going to the Indiana primary comes next, then West Virginia, then Maryland, then Nebraska, and Oregon. So I'd say we're going to have a busy spring.
You expect to campaign as vigorously all the way?
Oh, yes, we will. Not as much time as we spend in Wisconsin. Thank you.
And in the White House.
Boy, that's right.
I want to.
After the victory in Wisconsin, and you write all about that primary here in Wisconsin, which was so important. Here's Hubert Humphrey from Minnesota, a neighboring state. And I guess it was thought that Kennedy would win by a larger margin. Was that an accurate, do you think, expectation or not?
It became their expectation. It turned out to be a misguided one. No question that Wisconsin was the first of the critical contests that Kennedy had in the primary season. And the second one, of course, was shortly thereafter in West Virginia. But he spent several weeks there during that contest with Humphrey. And it was mapped out early in the Kennedy planning which primaries they would enter. And they selected Wisconsin because they felt they would have a shot to defeat Humphrey next door. Humphrey had a reputation as Wisconsin's third senator because that was during a time that Senator Joe McCarthy, in theory, been representing Wisconsin, but was not doing much for Wisconsin and a lot for chasing communists. Right. And so many people in Wisconsin looked to Senator Humphrey for help. So it was thought he was extremely popular and be very formidable in Wisconsin. So Kennedy felt, if I can go into Wisconsin and beat Hubert Humphrey there, that will be a devastating blow against Humphrey, who at that time was really the only opponent Kennedy was facing in the primaries.
Mm-hmm. Hubert Humphrey, another book could be written about him. You think about how he was at the periphery of so much, not that he wasn't a very effective senator and a real strong advocate for civil rights, et cetera. But here was this man, you almost feel sorry for him, don't you? That he's almost there, and then he doesn't quite get there.
He is, at times, is almost a pathetic figure.
Yes.
Because there was something very, very good about Hubert Humphrey. And yet he, she said, he never quite could make it once not only there in 60, but in 68 again, he comes so close and falls short. And a guy with a very admirable record in the Senate. You know, I think, you know, other than his unsuccessful runs, enormously admirable American political figure.
Mm-hmm. So did the Kennedys spend a lot of money? You write about all the pamphlets. They had labor pamphlets. They had all these pamphlets, door-to-door pamphlets, the day before the primary here. The JFK had been to the state so many times before 1960. He was really paving an election victory long before the actual primary.
Well, you know, he got involved early on. And in so many states, he went there early and established something of a beachhead. And he did especially a good job in Wisconsin by going out and helping William Proxmire in
yes.
his election, first in the special election to fill McCarthy's seat. And then Proxmire very quickly had to run for full term. And Kennedy went back to Wisconsin and helped him again. And so he earned the support of Senator Proxmire, which turned out to be very, very helpful in all of the machinations that were going on in Wisconsin, because Humphrey certainly had his own strong allies in the state. I believe Governor Gaylord Nelson being one of them, and Proxmire was able to checkmate Nelson at one point. No question, it was a very spirited campaign. The Kennedy people did become overconfident. They did allow themselves to suggest to the press that were covering this contest that they were going to win, they were going to win easily. And it turned out that they did, in fact, win the popular vote by something like 100,000 votes. But, of course, the delegates were allocated by individual congressional districts. And at the time, there were 10 CDs in Wisconsin, and Kennedy won only six of them. He didn't fare very well in, you know, the heavily Lutheran areas and the more rural parts of the state. Mm-hmm. His strongholds were places like, Milwaukee and, cities like Kenosha and Racine that had industry and a labor movement there that tended to support Kennedy. Kathleen, incidentally, one of the things I enjoyed in doing the research on Wisconsin, there is a documentary that I've discovered called Primary. And I think one can get it online.
Oh.
And it's nearly an hour. It was originally going to be funded by the Time Life operation.
Oh, yes.
And was going to be on the networks, and became somewhat controversial because people felt it was too pro-Kennedy, and it wound up never being aired in its entirety. But at the end, maybe 20 minutes of a nearly an hour-long documentary were shown, but especially for people in Wisconsin, it might be fun for them to check it out. It was a fellow named Robert Drew, I believe, who did the documentary, and I enjoyed very much watching it because they're in, you know, in black and white documentary. It's a very impressive account. It's as good as anything I've read about the Wisconsin.
Oh, you've given me my evening's entertainment. I thank you for that.
Sure.
Yeah. The other thing that happened is that because it was close and they thought they would win by a larger margin, Kennedy realized, oh boy, here goes West Virginia, and I can't sit back and relax here at all. I got to go there immediately and campaign hard.
To West Virginia.
Right.
Yeah, no question. And I think of the primaries that year, the two most interesting ones were Wisconsin. But Wisconsin's not as interesting as West Virginia was, without, in all deference to Wisconsin. And that was a very interesting primary. West Virginia was extremely dramatic, and it was by far the most dramatic moments of the campaign took place in West Virginia, and high controversy, and ultimately a lot of money from Daddy Warbeck, Joe Kennedy, helped bring it around. But that was one of the battles where Kennedy met head on the issue of Catholicism.
And here, let's hear what he had to say about that. This is from John Kennedy in West Virginia in 1960.
I would like to ask Senator Kennedy, how can we stop the religious issues that keep coming up to confuse the public?
Well, I think that I don't mind. I must say that we shouldn't boo, because it's a, I am running for the presidency, which is a powerful office, given great power under the Constitution, and it is a matter of concern to a good many people, and the best way to get it answered, it seems to me, is to ask the question openly and permit me to say that I support strongly the Constitution. I support strongly the separation of church and state. I believe it's the best arrangement for our society. I'm associated with it. Ma'am, I want to assure you that if I'm elected president, or if I continue in the Senate, that I shall continue my devotion to the Constitution and support of it.
And I believe at another time he talked about how he was in Congress and his brother, the Constitution allowed him to do that. His brother died for the country, and they were both Catholic. I mean, somehow what he had to say reassured people, didn't it?
Exactly. One of his speeches in West Virginia, he said, you know, my brother was killed. You know, I served in the military. Does that mean because we're Catholic that we're not fit, we're not qualified to serve this country as president? Very dramatic. And of course, West Virginia was heavily Protestant, very few Catholics in the state. It's another instance where Joe Kennedy says, don't go in there. You're crazy. There are no Catholics in the state. And when Joe Kennedy made this assertion at a strategy meeting, Jack Kennedy immediately got up and says, well, we've heard from the ambassador, and this is what we're going to do, and we're going to go into West Virginia. And they did. And once they're there, Joe Kennedy supplied them, nobody knows how much money, but a lot of money. It came in literally in black suitcases.
Wow.
Full of cash. No question.
Whoa.
Dick Donahue, who was one of the last survivors of the Irish Mafia, we were able to interview Dick shortly before he died, and Dick acknowledged that the money came in suitcases. Mm-hmm. It was handed out to sheriffs. You could get buy a vote for a couple of dollars and maybe a pint of whiskey. Having said that about the Kennedy money, Lyndon Johnson, who's still harboring the idea that he's going to win the thing at the convention, he is shipping in thousands of dollars from Texas to help fund the last gasp Humphrey campaign to try to block Kennedy from winning in West Virginia. So you've got all this Texas money coming in, too. So the whole state is awash with, and it's a very poor state, and it's suddenly awash with money.
So let's talk about who Kennedy is. He comes from this very wealthy family. He's in Congress. He's in the Senate. Now, all of a sudden, he's in a state that's dirt poor. And somehow, you say in the book, and I want you to talk more about this, that he really sees, maybe for the first time in his life, really, true poverty?
That is basically the thesis that so many people have developed. And I'm just going to first here just for a minute on a personal note. I've just come back from a trip to the Mississippi Delta on the 50th anniversary of a trip that Robert Kennedy took there when he discovered poverty and hunger and was confronted with it for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
And I covered that Bob Kennedy trip. And
did you really?
It shook him. He was clearly affected by it, and he went back to Washington and became a very passionate advocate of the poor. And I think it's no question that the same. I wasn't in West Virginia, but I think the same thing happened with Jack Kennedy, that he was shaken up. He went into the mines, unlike Humphrey. Humphrey didn't go into the mines, but Kennedy went into the mines and saw the workers face to face. And for all of his wealth and all of his Harvard education, he empathized with them.
Hmm. So what do you think about this race? Would he have won West Virginia if it had not been for those packets full of money?
I think he would have anyway. By that time, Humphrey had been so crippled by his defeat in Wisconsin. And there's really no other competition at that point. I think Kennedy won it going away. It was not even close. So I think, he would have prevailed without the money. But the old man had said, you know, whatever it takes, I'll provide it.
Hmm. You're also starting to see, certainly in Wisconsin with the old clips, and I'm sure in West Virginia, and what you saw with Bobby Kennedy. I saw Bobby Kennedy in Omaha, in Nebraska, back in 68, and I couldn't believe the response of the crowds to the Kennedy people. You just saw people being drawn to them. They had this, and I don't know how they got it, but people were attracted to them and incredibly enthusiastic.
They had charisma. It's just this kind of undefinable characteristic that not many politicians have, but they both had it.
Mm-hmm.
I was around Bobby Kennedy a little bit. I was never around Jack Kennedy, but just seeing the film clips, it's apparent that they both had it.
We are welcoming phone calls, too, and we have yet to get to the 1960 campaign. You can read the book in case we don't get to much of it because there's so much to talk about in this. It's a terrific book, The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's Five-Year Campaign. And one of the co-authors, Curtis Wilkie, is with us. Curtis was a national and foreign correspondent for the Boston Globe, teaches journalism, and now at the University of Mississippi. Our number is 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network.
I don't believe in big government, but I believe in effective governmental action. And I think that's the only way that the United States is going to maintain its freedom. It's the only way that we're going to move ahead. I think we can do a better job. I think we're going to have to do a better job if we are going to meet the responsibilities which time and events have placed upon us. We cannot turn the job over to anyone else. If the United States fails, then the whole cause of freedom fails.
The things that Senator Kennedy has said, many of us can agree with. And I subscribe completely to the spirit that Senator Kennedy has expressed tonight, the spirit that the United States should move ahead. Where then do we disagree? I think we disagree on the implication of his remarks tonight and on the statements that he has made on many occasions during his campaign to the effect that the United States has been standing still.
Richard Nixon and John Kennedy in the 1960, one of their televised debates. We'll talk about those as we continue. Let's go to phone calls. Kevin in Baraboo is our first caller for you. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, hi, Kathleen. Again, congratulations on your upcoming retirement.
Thank you.
I'm working in my studio here on some metal artwork, but I was thinking about a little situation that I had with my grandfather up in a little bit out of Wisconsin Rapids. He and my brother and I worked for my grandfather some during the summer, and we were out in the woods one day and just kind of having our lunch, and my grandfather pulled out a Kennedy half dollar out of his pocket, and then he pointed to that thing and said, "Best damn present we ever had." And my brother and I kind of like, "Ooh, wait a second, you know, we can't ever let Dad hear this," because he's a staunch Barry Goldwater Republican. Oh. And so therefore, you know, back in the mid to late 60s, my brother and I kind of got our first education into the differences between Republicans and Democrats and progressive and conservatives. And so I just had to share that. And that's all I had to say.
Thanks, Kevin. Brings back a lot of memories. You want to respond to that, Curtis?
Well, there was a definite delineation between the parties there, no question. This wasn't Tweedledum and Tweedledee. They had some sharp differences on foreign policy, and they had four very spirited debates that fall. Some people believe that that's what tipped the balance for Kennedy. However, Tom and I discovered in all the files at the Kennedy Library again, the surveys by Lou Harris, who was the pollster that the Kennedy campaign had hired, and he went into the field every morning after each of the debates, and he found that in none of them did the debate ever move the needle in the contest between Kennedy and Nixon. It was always very close, and there's no evidence that one of them suddenly shot Kennedy ahead and provided him with the winning ultimate margin.
We started the hour with Eisenhower. We're getting close, not there yet, to the end of the hour. What about Eisenhower's, it took him a while to get there, but finally his endorsement of Richard Nixon? Tell us what he first said about him, which was hardly an endorsement, but then...
Yeah, it was not helpful at all.
No, it sure wasn't.
Yeah, President Eisenhower was asked, you know, what are some of the things that Vice President Nixon has done that have been helpful for your administration? And Ike responded something to the effect, "Well, if you give me a couple of weeks, I might think of something."
Whoa.
And it was devastating. And nobody knows whether Eisenhower was trying to be jocular, and certainly he was not trying to undermine his party's candidate, but it certainly was not helpful at all.
But then he threw his support for Nixon, and did that make it a closer race?
That, no question that once Eisenhower, because he was a very popular president, and that was very helpful for Nixon. And there were times near the end when the Kennedy people despaired and were afraid that all was going to be lost, because that's how very close that contest wound up being.
Peter in Madison is next. Hello, Peter.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask your guest if he'd come across the writings of Jerry Bruno, which is Auto worker from Kenosha and ended up becoming part of the Kennedy campaign team.
He writes about
him. Jerry Bruno figures prominently in a couple of places in our book. Jack Kennedy discovered him during the time he was out helping Proxmire. And Bruno had gotten his start in politics with Proxmire and became an advance man. He, of course, had worked in a factory in Kenosha, I believe. And suddenly he's this advance man extraordinaire. And Kennedy likes the cut of his jib, as they might say in New England, and hires him. And Bruno became, you know, the lead advance guy. And you know, no question, he was he wasn't Irish mafia, but he was a very valuable personality in that campaign.
Wasn't he then the godson to some big Kennedy? Was it Ethel's godson or what? Remember that?
That I don't know. I do know that there's another character from Wisconsin, not as admirable as Jerry Bruno.
Oh, it's the other one,
Corbin.
Then. Right, right.
It's the guy who shows up, and I think he changed his name to something that sounded more Irish and kind of latched on to the Kennedy campaign. He would show up like a bad penny at any number of places. And he... Corbin converted to Catholicism and got both Bob and Ethel Kennedy to be his godparents. I bet that's who.
That's what I was thinking of.
Right. It's pretty funny. And he was believed to have surreptitiously flooded one of the heavily Catholic districts in Wisconsin with anti-Catholic leaflets, so that using reverse psychology, the voters would think, you know, that this is the work of Humphrey,
right,
trying to trash Catholics. And Corbin was responsible for that. And he later had a fairly nefarious role in the general election in New York. But, you know, that's another story, as you say.
Peter, thanks for your call. Randy in Madison, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Kathleen, I hope you enjoy your free afternoons going into the fall.
Thanks, Randy.
And certainly, and I've also seen the movie, the documentary Primary, and it's pretty fascinating on a number of fronts. And one of the things that struck me when I saw it is that you're seeing a level of rhetoric, or just plain speaking, that I think was exemplified by that little clip you played, where he's responding to the reporter's question about his Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
You have a well chosen full sentences. You have a train of logic. Other places you have actual inspiration. Just coming out of the core of the information, and not to be too leading, but you just don't hear that anymore. For the guest, I'm wondering, what do you think has happened to political rhetoric and just plain stump speaking?
That's a good question. I wish I had an answer, and I wish there were a way to restore it to the level that you're describing, because certainly it was more elevated, not only in that contest between Kennedy and Humphrey, but even in the debates between Kennedy and Nixon, the level of political discourse today, and particularly on the national level, is quite disgraceful.
Thank you very much for the call, Randy. Yeah, he always had, and he may not have been a very well-known national figure, but he sure had a wit about him, didn't he? There have been books about that. He could turn a phrase.
Oh, yeah, no question. And quite a good sense of humor.
Yes, absolutely.
Some things were quite biting. He had some very funny exchanges down through years with Eugene McCarthy, the senator from Minnesota, who was Hubert Humphrey's, later, ironically, you know, ran against Humphrey in 68, but... he was Humphrey's campaign manager both in 1956 at the convention when Humphrey, there was another case where Humphrey failed in his contest with Kennedy, and then in 1960, you know, J. Gene McCarthy was a fairly sardonic and funny guy himself, also Catholic, and he and Jack Kennedy had some pretty interesting exchange between them.
Well, you have a pretty interesting book, Curtis. We're out of time. I'm sorry to say goodbye. I could talk to you for hours, but thank you so much for being with us and for writing the book.
Kathleen, thank you so much for having me, and enjoy talking to you.
Yeah, our pleasure. Curtis Wilkie, the book is The Road to Camelot, Inside JFK's Five-Year Campaign. If you're interested in the Kennedy time, you'll find this book fascinating. Thanks very much to Colleen Leahy and Gretchen Brown for producing and for doing on-air production. That's it for us for this week. So hasta lunes, right? Lunes is Monday. Hasta lunes.